Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 31st of March 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host. With me in the studio, as always, Mike Robinson. And we are, delighted to say we're joined by David Scott with Northern Exposure today, who's David's going to be reporting, of course, on events north of the border. Exposure feeling a bit nippy?
Yes, indeed. Let's just get straight on with it, David. You insisted in putting this story in, much to my complaints, but let's have your discussion of the photograph of Nippy.
This is spectacular, Mike. How could you not, as a connoisseur of human failings and the bizarre world in which we now live, how could you not love this photograph? Now, I would have to say, for viewers in England or anywhere else where rationality still holds, this is not a photograph of a 17-year-old girl writing to her boyfriend. This is not a photograph of someone who's going to sign off and instead of a little eye, a dot above the eye, put a little heart. This is not what this is. This, apparently, is a photograph of the First Minister of Scotland writing to the Prime Minister to explain why we need a new independence referendum with a view to breaking up the United Kingdom, a country that's been in existence for over 300 years, and in order so that Scotland can remain inside the EU, but not in a funny kind of way. It gets complicated at that point. But here we have soft lighting. We have her curled up on the sofa, her feet tucked under her, looking very girly. I'm astounded by that photograph, and it's been put out by the Scottish Government. That's an official Scottish Government pick. So we're now making up for having no policy with having glamour shots of Nicola Sturgeon. Well, how do you feel about that?
David, if I may, I think I can explain this photograph because, of course, there's been a lot of consternation about the Daily Mail showing her legs and also the legs of Theresa May. Not quite bare. I think they had tights on or something like that. So I think this is to counter it. So it's focused on her top half and she's looking very demure, very feminine, which is only appropriate, of course. I think this is a lovely photo.
Well, I'm glad you're touched. In fact, this might be the start of a whole new relationship, Brian.
He is touched, David. He is. There's no question. Okay. Now let's move quickly on to Brexit. And I just want to highlight this article. Thanks to Alex for sending it through to me. This is from Stephen Wolfe, who is an independent MEP for North West England. It's entitled, "If We Haven't Left the European Arrest Warrant, We Haven't Left the EU." He says that on Tuesday, the 28th of February, I had the pleasure to speak alongside the principled and erudite Jacob Rees-Mogg MP in one of the historic committee rooms of the House of Commons. The event was hosted by Conservatives for Liberty, and the subject was on the topic I've championed for years, well before I was elected an MEP. It was the European arrest warrant, and I stated as a matter of principle that the UK should withdraw from the EAW at the upcoming Brexit negotiations. And he went on to describe examples of why we should. I do recommend you go and read it. He ended up by saying the issues around the EAW might not get as much TV time as other issues surrounding Brexit, but the government must make withdrawing from it in the negotiations an absolute priority. You cannot put a price on our freedom. If we've not left the European arrest warrant, then we've not left the European Union. Now, in a similar vein, last night, well, very early this morning, I published this on my Facebook page. Please share it around if you can. Brexit, nothing of the kind. I'm discussing similar topics, not European arrest warrant, but I'm discussing the issues around whether we're actually leaving the European Union or not, and comparing Theresa May's current policy with what David Cameron was promoting just prior to the referendum. So nothing seems to have changed since then. And that was when David Cameron was promoting his policies with a view to remaining within the European Union. Theresa May promoting her policies, saying that we're leaving the European Union. But in fact, the policies appear to be exactly the same. So please have a look at that and share it if you think it's appropriate. And just want to highlight this from a couple of days ago. It's from City AM. Now, this is the only source I can find for this story, so let's keep it with that caveat in mind. Cost-cutting BBC drops international news agency Associated Press, citing financial pressures. And what the what City AM is talking about here is an email from Ms. Unworth, the head of the overseas BBC. What's it called?
BBC Media.
No. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Monitoring, BBC Monitoring.
No, we can.
BBC Global.
No. Look, we'll just mention that in the email, she had said that Associated Press was getting too expensive. The BBC is suffering financial pressures, as you do if you've got a £3.6 billion budget. So the BBC is suffering financial pressures. They've got to drop Associated Press. And who are they signing up to instead? Agence France-Presse, so AFP. So what is this, Brian, the consolidation of European media?
Well, without question, Mike, because we've shown a couple of times this huge amalgamation of press sources, including TV-type media and press driven by Google, strongly put together in France. And all this is apparently to counter those nasty terrorists using social media. So, yeah, this is the amalgamation of a European wide media circus. And, of course, the European Union consistently says that people who support the European Union are not, I'll say, allowed to report it in anything but a good light. So this is a propaganda machine like we've never seen before, really.
Yeah, and thanks to Alex. Of course, she's head of BBC World Service.
That was the World one
I was
Service.
Looking for. Yes.
I was listing them, but I didn't get to the world bit.
Okay, now, yesterday, Amber Rudd was holding a meeting with what she describes communication service providers. These are big internet companies. These were being described as showdown talks. And so who was there? Well, Google, Microsoft, Twitter, and Facebook. Some people described it as being hauled before the Home Secretary. Anyway, she issued a statement following this meeting, and she said, my starting point is pretty straightforward. I don't think that people who want to do us harm should be able to use the internet or social media to do so. I want to make sure we're doing everything we can to stop this. It was a useful discussion. I'm glad to see that progress has been made. We focused on the issue of access to terrorist propaganda online and the very real and evolving threat that it poses. I said I wanted to see this tackled head on, and I welcome the commitment from the key players to set up a cross-industry forum that will help to do this. I'm taking forward this work, and I'd like to see the industry go further and faster in not only removing online terrorist content, but stopping it going up in the first place. I'd also like to see more support for smaller and emerging platforms to do this as well, so they can no longer be seen as an alternative shop floor by those who want to do us harm. So here are the organizations that were mainly involved in this: Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and Twitter. And they produced an open letter following this meeting. They said, thank you to Amber Rudd for the constructive discussion today on the challenges that terrorism poses to everyone. We welcome, they said, the opportunity to share with you details of the progress already made in this area and to hear how the UK government is developing its approach in both online and offline space. We believe that companies, academics, civil society and government all have an interest and responsibility to respond to the danger of terrorist propaganda online. And as an industry, we're committed to doing more. So what are they going to do? Well, first, they're going to encourage further development of technical tools to identify and remove terrorist propaganda. What terrorist propaganda is not defined. Second, to support younger companies that can benefit from the expertise and experiences of more established ones. And third, and this is the one that I find the most disturbing, to support the efforts of civil society organizations to promote alternative and counter narratives. So what they're saying here is that first of all, they're going to censor the internet. And third of all, they are going to encourage not only the censorship of the internet, but civil society organizations to promote propaganda, which are considered to be counter narratives. And they say that our companies have already invested in existing programs to support civil society. The programs like Civil Society Empowerment Program highlight the potential benefits of greater collaboration. Again, the industry does not see this work as one where we compete, but rather as an opportunity to provide support whose value is greater than the individual contributions. David, this is a pretty staggering step by these organizations.
We were talking about this last night in Glasgow. Gord Atzmann was covering this, that the internet will be denied to us, he felt, quite shortly, that the reasonably unfettered access we now enjoy to ideas of all sorts will be a thing of the past, and it will be closed down because there are the powers that be, the powers that shouldn't be, are clearly losing control of the public discourse, the public narrative. The mainstream media has completely lost the confidence of the public because there are counter-narratives being put forward, and those counter-narratives are carrying the day, and they're going to shut us down. And this just seems like it's happening, well, right now.
It's happening. This is happening in plain sight, isn't it? It just comes down to putting the pieces together. They're not really bothering to try and hide what's going on at the moment. I totally agree. I'm sure Mike does. This is a complete close down of the internet. And why are they doing it? Yeah, agree with you, David, because truth is coming to the surface just too quickly for the big propaganda machines like the BBC to respond.
The other attack on this is through the online advertising space. We've already seen Google and Facebook expressing their concern that they're losing some pretty big customers because the big customers don't want their advertising shown alongside what they're considering extremist content. We now have articles appearing in the mainstream press saying that that some of the big companies are noticing that when their advertising has been removed from some of the smaller websites, they're not seeing any difference in returns in terms of product bought or whatever, and they're asking the question, why would they advertise on, you know, 500,000 websites when they can advertise on 5,000 websites and get the same result? So we're already starting to see an attack on the incomes of small websites that rely on advertising revenue to keep themselves going. This is pretty dangerous, David.
Yeah, this is also, we're seeing changes in policy in organizations like YouTube. Now, YouTube went down the route of opening up monetization options for the people who drive the content, the people who make the documentaries, the interviews, everything that makes YouTube a success, everything that makes it worth watching, comes from the people who provide the content. And to encourage that content and drive the content to YouTube, YouTube opened up access to advertising revenue to all of these content producers. And this was a very successful model, and it's been tremendous, but it's changing. Now you have a thing called restrictive mode. Very interesting. Not only will high schools and such like be operating wholly in restrictive mode, but if you're not logged in and you start to search YouTube, you'll be searching the restricted mode version of YouTube. Now, this is politically motivated. One of the sites I follow from America, a channel called Louder with Crowder, which is pro-libertarian, pro-conservative, skeptical about Trump, hostile to new wave feminism, hostile to politically correct speech control, this sort of thing, he's bringing forward a very entertaining program looking at politics, looking at current affairs, and the opposition is the Young Turks, who are pro Hillary Clinton, pro Democratic Party. Now, the Louder with Crowder quote unquote right wing program is it started off as a radio show, so it had to comply with all the regulations for going out on terrestrial radio in America. So there's no swearing, there's a beep button, and you know, it's family friendly, it's all of these things. The Young Turks swear constantly, because unless you use the F word four times every sentence, you don't know it's real talk, right? With all this profanity and all this swearing all the way through the program. Now, imagine my surprise to find that in restricted mode, the Young Turks, all of the content is there. But if you go to the opposing political view, Louder with Crowder, nothing. Zero. Every video they've ever put up disappears when you go into restricted mode. So the only possible explanation as to why is wrong political opinions. It's censorship. It's plain and simple censorship.
Yep. This is why we have witnessed our viewing figures going down from time to time. Yeah. Okay, let's move swiftly on. The F-35, a new report, gives it an absolute slating. This report is from this organization, the Project and Government Oversight, and their sub-project, the Strauss Military Reform Project. They're saying that the F-35 has a long way to go before it will be ready for combat. This was the message of Dr. Michael Gilmore, who is a retired director of operational test and evaluation. They're saying that the Joint Strike Fighter program has already consumed more than $100 billion nearly 25 years. And just to finish the basic development phase is going to require an extra $1 billion and two more years. Why are we talking about this? Well, the F-35, of course, or variant of it, is supposed to be appearing on our new aircraft carriers at some point in the future, if ever. He detailed a range of remaining and sometimes worsening problems with the program. And I'm just going to give you a feel for this. I do recommend that you go and read this report, but I'll just give you a feel for the type of things that they're talking about here. They're saying that the electronics that are used to justify the cost are not delivering the capabilities that they claim to be. They're saying that it's ineffective as a fighter. They're saying that it's ineffective as an interdiction bomber. They're saying it's ineffective as a close air support platform. They're saying that the Navy's F-35 is unsuitable for carrier operations. They're saying that the price tag is the only thing that's stealthy about the F-35. They say that combat effectiveness is at risk. And they're saying that it's obviously got reliability program problems. We knew about that anyway. And they're saying that officials are hiding the truth about the F-35's problems and delays from taxpayers. So, Brian, this does not look terribly good for the British carrier operations.
Well, of course, it's adding disaster to disaster, Mike. We've got one carrier sort of ready to go, but we haven't got enough qualified men to man the thing. Jetty just about... We've got the jetty named, of course, so that's a good thing, but...
Yes.
But we haven't really got the carrier operational, and now we're saying we haven't got an aircraft to go on the thing. So we've got a disaster. But this is going to tie in with reports that have come out, particularly in the Times, saying there's a $10 billion shortfall in defence. What I see here is the weapon to completely destroy the Royal Navy, because, of course, we've spent all this money on the carriers, $6.5 billion, no aircraft for them. So... what have you got? A piece of, I'm going to use the term junk. I'm sure somebody will get upset at that. You've got a piece of £6.5 billion worth of junk, no aircraft. So it's a complete white elephant. Okay. Is it deliberate?
It's no problem. We'll sell it to Turkey for £1 million.
Sell it to Turkey for scrap.
What you have is a target. You've got a liability unless it's effective fighting, part of an effective integrated fighting force. You've got a liability.
Yep.
You've got something to for other people to shoot at. We were discussing this off air some weeks ago, Brian. The fact that you need integrated defence to have a carrier group able to operate safely.
Well, this
the vulnerability of an aircraft carrier. The fact that you need proper anti-submarine, anti-mine defence in order to go anywhere with their relative safety.
This is absolutely
before you even get.
This is absolutely true, David. Sorry, I'll just push this point home. You are absolutely correct, because of course you can't operate a carrier on its own. You've got to have other ships to provide an integrated air defence. You've got to have the anti-submarine defence, and if you're going to go near a a harbour, you've got to have the mine warfare defence. So what is remarkable is we're to believe that suddenly common sense military decisions simply disappeared. And we then started to scrap perfectly good ships. We were planning carriers, but we didn't have any aircraft for them. We haven't got any trained men. We can't produce a Type 45 that works in warm water. There is something seriously wrong. This is not accident. This is not military people suddenly changing. If you follow it through, this is deliberate treason. We are watching that our defence forces, our military are being destroyed by a coordinated plan. And that plan has been executed by both the Labour Party, the Lib Dems, of course, and the Tories. This is treason. We're watching it unfold.
Well, you mentioned the defence cuts, and I think you're going to say a bit more about that in a second, Brian. But today is the meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Brussels. And so we've got to ask about these defence cuts and how this fits with this meeting. We'll understand this in a second. So Jens Stoltenberg gave a statement just in the lead up to the meeting this morning. He said, today we prepare the ground for the meeting of NATO leaders here in Brussels in May. Our transatlantic bond has been rock solid for almost 70 years. It's vital for Europe and vital for North America, and it's especially important now in times of serious challenges. And he then went on to discuss talk about what they're going to be discussing. He said, first, fair burden sharing to keep the transatlantic bond strong. We've started to increase defence spending, but we need to keep up the momentum and meet the pledge we've all made. This is about more funding. So you've got to ask, if they're holding a meeting today with foreign ministers, which Boris Johnson is at, and he's saying that this is all about more funding, and on the same day we've got a report saying that Michael Fallon's going to cut, or at least he's refusing to deny that he's going to make further cuts to British defence spending, while at the same time lying that we continue to meet our NATO obligations. This clearly is pointing at European Defence Union here.
Yeah, I would say so. And of course, you want to close down the British military. So it's a tiny little quasi-defence force sitting on the side that can be sucked in, manipulated by the big EU unified force, which, of course, is going to be completely controlled by the Germans.
Right. OK, well, Stoltenberg said the second major topic will be stepping up NATO's efforts to project stability and fight terrorism. And then over lunch, they're going to talk about relationships with Russia. Our key partners, the European Union, Finland and Sweden, will join the talks. So the European Union specifically being cited there. We have a united position on Russia, strong defence and deterrence combined with a dialogue, and we're delivering on both. This sounds a bit like the IRA strategy of the ballot box and the bomb is pretty much what he's talking about here. Interesting. And then he says we're going to close the ministerial meeting with a meeting of the NATO-Ukraine Commission, a strong sign of our continued commitment to Ukraine. Our support is both political and practical. So there we go. That's what they're going to be talking about. Then they all met in the main meeting hall. Stoltenberg gave another short address to the media at the opening of the first meeting. He said pretty much the same things. And what was interesting, I just wanted to comment that Boris Johnson couldn't be bothered turning up in time for that.
He arrived probably couldn't late. Get up, Mike.
Yeah, yes. Maybe he was out running or something. I don't know.
Yeah. David, just a quick comment for you. How do you see an independent Scotland and independent Scotland military fitting into this little organisation?
Well, the unique thing about an independent Scotland is, despite the fact that we've been talking about it now for maybe a decade, we actually know less about these things, Brian, than we did 10 years ago. We've no idea what an independent Scottish military would look like. We've no idea what our currency we would use. We've no idea whether we would have a central bank. We've no idea about anything, because none of these questions are answered. It's details. The principle is vote for independence now. I agitate for independence, and whatever your dreams happen to be will come true. And in terms of details, well, don't you worry your pretty little head, Brian, about the details. It'll all be fine because Scottish. That is the official policy. It's not a straw man. There are no answers. What sort of military do we want to have? A non-nuclear one under the NATO nuclear umbrella, I think. And we appear to be having a policy where we will force the Royal Navy out of the Clyde, where they have enormous bases costing billions, not all that many years ago. Then what? I don't know. There is no policy. It's a shambles. In terms of independence, well, the one thing we do know is there's no hint that we'd be following any sort of an independent policy, because it would be entirely dominated by Europe and by Germany.
Yeah. Well, let's follow the defence thing through. This is the part of the report over 10 billion. We're so incompetent now, we've sort of lost track of 10 billion. We wanted some equipment, but we couldn't quite work out how much it had cost. And we've lost track of that cost, Mike. Just 10 billion sort of disappeared, really.
Well, indeed, as it does.
Yeah, well, we're not going to get the answer from this lady. We've talked about her before, Deborah Haynes, defence editor for The Times. This is her Twitter page. Just incredible, really, the way this lady deals with stuff. She's just reporting on this madness. It's quite normal, so she trots it all out. She says the government is consumed by Brexit. It doesn't want to hear bad news about defence funding. This is just a bit of bad news.
Oh,
really.
I see. We lost 10 billion because we're consumed with Brexit. Is that it?
Yeah, that's what she says. Aircraft carriers, F-35s and Trident, they're going to suck all the money out of the military, so that's a bit bad. Senior officers apparently warning of a hollow force. Well, that's an understatement. The Royal Marines are going to lose another 200 Marines, and then they're going to be rolled away from frontline duties. They're probably put in prison. That's the usual thing. One of the casualties of the funding crisis is the Royal Marines, as sources accuse Navy of sacrificing sense to support armed carriers. Now, this is very, very insidious reporting, because what she's doing is playing people off against each other. No better way of causing trouble in the military than to have the RAF played off against the Army, or the Army played off against the Navy. You get all of the heads at each other's throats instead of focused on the MPs who are driving this lot. So this woman is not going to do any proper in-depth investigation and reporting. And this is the reason I knew what the story about Nippy was, because here's Deborah Haynes. What's important, not the fact we've got chaos in defence, not that we've lost £10 billion. The most important thing for Deborah Haynes is some nasty man has put these two ladies' legs on the front page of the paper. And she says this is absolutely terrible. How could anybody do it? Legs, not the 10 billion. But if you go through her own Twitter page, it's the most immature dross how this woman gets away with it. Until she is removed from the Times, we're not going to see any proper reporting. So no in-depth analysis, questioning of the Conservative policy to destroy the military, the French taking over the nuclear deterrent. And although this is the Telegraph, this is the state of it. Forces brace for more cuts in defence cash squeeze. It's a bit of a squeeze now. We haven't just lost 10 billion. It's a little bit of a squeeze. But what's the article mentioning here? Well, we're going to have warships that have no surface-to-surface missiles, so we might as well send them off to Turkey as well. But this isn't a problem. It's Nippy's legs that we should be focused on, apparently.
Yes, OK. Well, let's move on then to international development. Companies to Inspire Africa 2017. This is the London Stock Exchange. They say they've always played a central role in bringing together ambitious growing companies from around the world with globally minded investors. And key to that role is a continual effort to raise awareness in emerging markets of the unrivaled investor base that exists in London, seeking exposure to new geographies and opportunities. And so they've set up a conference for this. Companies to Inspire Africa, being run by the London Stock Exchange Group. In that spirit, the London Stock Exchange Group has undertaken an unparalleled research project in partnership with Africa Development Bank Group, the Commonwealth Development Company, and PricewaterhouseCoopers to reveal Africa's most inspiring small and medium-sized enterprises. Let's have a look at what was in the agenda. Priti Patel was speaking first. Then there's a keynote address from the Division Chief of the Capital Markets Development Division, the African Development Bank Group. Lord Botang is going to be speaking. Aside from being in the House of Lords, he's the African Enterprise Challenge Fund. Then there's a panel on private equity landscape in Africa. So it's all about money and how they can make profit out of third world countries. As I say, Commonwealth Development Company there as well. We've also got some of the big banks and PricewaterhouseCoopers, Citigroup, and so on. Now, what did Priti Patel have to say? She said that millions face starvation in southern Sudan, Somalia, Nigeria, and that the UK is leading the relief effort. But we're obviously going to improve matters for them by asking them to issue bonds and putting them in more debt. She said liberal markets, trade, finance and investment have the power to transform some of the poorest parts of the world. We must tackle the root causes of poverty, conflict and instability and end the culture of corrosive governance. We must make sure that Africa is open for business and investment is flowing in. She said that the Commonwealth Development Company Group has created more than 1 million jobs in the last year. What's the population of African countries? This is fantastic. But this was the best quote. I want to see the City of London establishing itself as the global financial centre for the developing world. I thought this was a spectacular thing for her to say. David, this is the continuing rape of Africa by the City of London. She's encouraging the issuance of bonds and more debt. Don't worry about that. People are starving, and the best way out of it is to take on a load of extra debt.
Yes, because that's worked so well in the past. Africa has seen its resources stolen via compound interest, time after time after time. And ironically enough, there are in fact many good news stories coming out of Africa, and the one piece of technology which has transformed the situation for the lives of many, many people in Africa is not, in fact, anything to do with the City of London or the IMF or loans or huge infrastructure or any of these things. It's the humble mobile phone, because smartphones, etc., have given people in Africa not only a method to communicate, but a means of secure payment. And that, the fact that someone can't come and nick your stuff at the end of a business day, the fact that you actually are sure that you've been paid and that it's not funny money or a check that's going to bounce, that has been the biggest single spur to economic development that Africa's had since the end of the colonial days. And that should be celebrated. And of course, this is Africans doing things in Africa for themselves, to better their own condition. It didn't require any central planning, didn't require any input from the City of London.
Right. Well, let's move on to human trafficking then. And you wanted to highlight this article from Neon Nettle. Human trafficker admits to killing over 400 children in video confession.
It's a remarkable piece of video. And it's the ex-actor Ross Kemp he's done various documentaries and things. So he found himself out interviewing this chap who abducts children. And he's asking them via translator about what he does with the children, how much he gets and how much they're worth to him. And then if there's trouble, if people create too much fuss, does he give the children back? And he says, no, if there's too much fuss, we kill the children and we bury the bodies. And when pushed, you know, how many it's girls that this chap is stealing from the communities in. How many bodies, how many girls have you killed? He said, well, we don't keep count, but, you know, about 400 or 500. And at the end of this, you can see the translator's in tears, because this is her own community, and she's finding out where all the missing girls are going. And you're seeing here just another little bit of evidence that the world over, children are a commodity, and murder of them when it's convenient to do so seems to be unbelievably common.
While you were talking us through that, David, I was just doing a rough calculation, because the sum that we are consistently told now is that the moment the British state takes a child, they've put a value of £70,000 on the child. What happens after that? It starts to rocket, depending whether that child goes for prostitution or for films, whatever it is. But if you take your 500 children, a basic of £70,000 per child, that's, I think, 35 million, if I've got that sum right. So we're talking vast amounts of money. And the other exceptionally, I'm going to use the word creepy, thing is that we now know that British Child Protection Services simply talk about the children as assets. Indeed, we've got one charity calling them core assets. So this is big money, very big money. And how appropriate that we've gone into this subject immediately after talking about the City of London moving into Africa, supposedly to help the Africans with food and economy. Well, we can add to a bit more to this, because let's come back to the Wiltshire policeman, Mike Veal, who's looking into accusations of child abuse by Edward Heath. So we've got Mike Veal lower left on screen, but the man we've got above him is Lord Armstrong. And I'm going to say thank you very much to one of our viewers who said you need to look at a recent exchange in the House of Lords. This was the 7th of March this year. And what's actually happening here is Lord Armstrong starts off by saying to ask Her Majesty's Government, in the light of the recent statement by the Chief Constable of Wiltshire Police, whether they will institute a judicial inquiry into that force's Operation Conifer with, quote, unrestricted access to all relevant information. Here he goes. This is Lord Armstrong. The response here from Baroness Williams, Minister of State Home Office: my lords, the police are operationally independent of government. The investigation of allegations of sexual abuse and how the police conduct those investigations, including whether to commission any form of internal inquiry, are operational matters for the relevant chief officer. So she attempts to answer him, but back he comes. Here's Lord Armstrong. And look at this. My lords, having served in the Home Office for 4 years, I understand about the operational independence of police, but this matter has gone beyond operational affairs. It's become a matter of confidence in the police and the police service. And here he is saying that he says the officer in charge of the inquiry made a stupid mistake, but he said he pronounced a verdict of guilty on the late Sir Edward Heath in respect of allegations of child abuse even before the inquiry was complete. Well, this is just remarkable that he's using his position in the House of Lords to attack that Wiltshire police investigation. The dialogue goes on, so there's further comment by Baroness Williams. And then in comes Lord Rosser. And this is also exceptionally interesting. He says the newspaper quotations last month came from an anonymous source claiming to know the views of the Chief Constable for Wiltshire. This raises the issue of the relationship between the police and the national press and makes the case for Leveson 2 even more important. So we've got Lord Rosser, Labour, using his position in the House of Lords to undermine the inquiry and call for greater clampdown via Leveson. And that is exactly what we predicted on the 20th of February when we pointed out the fake news. That's the minimum. This was the Daily Mail lining up the Chief Constable so that he could be attacked. And we see that attack in the House of Lords. So people can freeze these screens and have a look at it. But I found this so cynical. There's no talk about child abuse victims or the survivors. The dialogue is ended by Baroness Williams telling people what the procedure is for removing a chief constable. So who is this man? Well, he's here. And of course, he was picked up by the Mail because he wouldn't name an MP where there were strong allegations of abuse. So Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet chief defends failure to act over senior Tory. You can read this yourself, but of course seen against one of his colleagues, which was Tim Fortescue, chief whip, saying they would come to us with problems to do with small boys and we fixed it. I mean, this is untenable. David, I've got a little bit more to follow up on this with a bit of comment on the BBC, but you could not make this up. On one hand, we're saying there's no evidence. Then when a police officer is trying to do his job, they undermine him. We've got the chief whip of the Heath government telling the BBC they were abusing boys.
Yes, indeed we do. The switcheroo between this is an operational matter, we can't possibly comment, and lots of comment is quite wondrous to behold. The operational comment excuse, we know from the Holly Gregg campaign and many other areas, is the go-to excuse for, I don't want to answer that question, please go away. And then when you start to see a lot of comment and a lot of attacks coming in the House of Lords, of all places, the very place, is formerly the highest court in the land, wasn't it? The very place that actually should have the greatest respect for the law and the greatest respect for the rights of the victims of child sexual abuse. To see them attacking not only Chief Constable, but the whole process of seeking justice is quite sickening.
It's abhorrent. It's just been pointed out to us by somebody in our chat box that Baroness Williams is actually the government's chief whip in the House of Lords. So this is the inner circle at work. Have a look at the BBC here, because, of course, what's the BBC been doing? It's been doing its best to pump out propaganda to protect Edward Heath. And who do they use? Lord Armstrong. I knew him, Edward Heath, for 35 years, worked closely with him. And then he says, you usually detect some sense of sexuality when your friends will work closely with him. I think he was asexual. There are some people like that. And of course, it isn't just one part of the BBC, because here we've got BBC Radio. Lord Armstrong quoted saying, handling of Heath allegations are against justice and unfair. And I was intrigued to see this when I went looking for Lord Armstrong, that when you come up against his little CVs against various organisations that he's now involved in, it mentions Margaret Thatcher, but he seems to have forgotten about Mr. Heath, doesn't exist. But this is the man that we need to be paying attention to. This is Mike Veal, Chief Constable for Wiltshire. What a brave man. If you haven't seen this video, watch this video where he explains why he is doing what he is doing for this investigation. And as a result of UK Column coming in and supporting this man and his video, this is what's happened with the viewing figures. In 2 days, we've gone from about 1,500 views up to 5,000, but it should be 500,000 views. We should have millions of people in UK listening to this man, not watching this devious stuff going on in the House of Lords.
So we need to say to everybody that has that is watching today, we want to set you a target to find 10 people in your immediate circle to watch this video, and to get each of them to share this video and encourage 10 people to do the same. And then perhaps we might see this at the 500,000 mark.
Yeah, and we can tell viewers and listeners today that it's clear that Wiltshire Police have been very surprised and very pleased at the fact that they're seeing members of the public now coming forward to support the work that they're doing.
Now, David, we're pretty much out of time, but there's a couple of things we absolutely want to get through here. So let's keep this brief as possible. But Sean Ritchie, first of all, remind us who Sean Ritchie is, and then give us the background to this story. Sorry, say that again, because go ahead.
Officially, Sean Ritchie is a missing person. If you ask Police Scotland, it's an ongoing investigation into a missing person. Right? In reality, Sean Ritchie is sadly a victim of a murder. And his body's never been found. and his relatives, his mum in particular, have been fighting now for several years to get the proper investigation that the case requires carried out. Now, there have been searches. There have been searches cancelled. There have been quite a number of reports in the mainstream press. But we have interviewed Sean Ritchie's mother, and we'll be putting that that interview out in the next week or so. It's a fascinating interview. And what comes across is a mother who loved her son and who wants justice and who wants the truth and is very clear, and that is her objective. Now, she has now been charged by Police Scotland. Eight charges she's facing, so they've not messed around here. Eight charges of wasting police time. This relates to threatening messages that the family received, basically along the lines of "stop asking awkward questions or your kids will get it, get the same that Sean got." Things like that, nasty, threatening, violent, vile messages. So the family received these messages. They reported them to Police Scotland. Police Scotland have now suggested that Sean Ritchie's mum was the author of these messages. I would have to say I've interviewed her. You'll be able to hear in her own words her answering that charge. I'm absolutely convinced that she is innocent of this. And I would encourage when we do publish this tape, this transcript, please please listen to it, because here you've got someone campaigning for justice, campaigning for a murdered son, and rather than being supported by the police, she's now been targeted by the police. And it's the police in Peterhead, the same police force, the same police officers that we came across in the Brian and Janice Doherty case. It's very troubling indeed.
Okay, now, David, we have a little video clip from the Scottish Government regarding mental health. And before we comment on this, let's just briefly look at it. It's about 30 seconds or maybe a minute or so. So here we go.
As the first ever dedicated Minister for Mental Health, the simple guiding principle for the strategy today is that we should have parity of esteem between physical and mental health, so that if you have a mental health problem, it's treated in exactly the same way as a physical health problem would be. The strategy has been developed by involving a wide range of organisations over the last few months. So I've met youth organisations, I've met service users, I've met people who are providing services for those with mental health. A wide range of people have helped develop the strategy. The simple fact is that people should be able to ask once, get help fast, so that people will be able to access services through A&E departments, through police stations, and wherever they pitch up and need it.
So, David, the police are now going to become the first point of contact for people with mental health issues in Scotland. That is a major demolition of the separation of powers.
It is a smoking ruin where the separation of powers used to lie. And it gets into this agenda, which we're seeing played out now in Scotland and across the UK, of vulnerable persons, right? If you are defined as vulnerable, then the police want to help you, or the police will take an interest in you. The police will have some sort of duty to interact with you, to affect your life, because you're vulnerable. And who defines vulnerable? I've got a definition here. According to, this is actually for a Canadian Act, but it's much the same. A vulnerable person is an adult living with a mental disability who is in need of assistance to meet his or her basic needs with regards to personal care and or management of his or her property. So if you are defined as vulnerable, then the police can interact with you, the police can help you, whether you want that help or not. Your financial matters, the control of your property, and ultimately your liberty can all be affected by the police, but it's for your own good, and you've committed no crime. Now, this is Soviet. This is how the Soviets used to silence opposition, because you would simply be defined, because you opposed the regime, you would be defined as insane, and you would be locked up, and there would be no trial, there would be no accusation, there would be no facing your accuser, there would be no 15 men, good and true, or jury of your peers, none of this. You would just disappear. And I have to say, this is where this country's going.
David, thank you very much for that. We had some other material to put with that. We can't do it today. We'll save that for next week. But I can say that we were contacted yesterday by a gentleman who's now in Inverness in a psychiatric hospital, having been picked up by the police. He's being held for 28 days and he has been forcibly medicated. So the reality is this gulag is nearly upon us. We're going to say there's three types of people. There are people awake and are doing things. There are people who are awake and they are watching. And there are people still asleep. And it's vital. It is absolutely vital. The people who are awake are now people doing. So if you would like something to do this weekend, get that letter of support written for Mike Veal. Get the letters written to politicians asking why Melanie Shaw's still in prison. Start warning your friends and neighbours as to what is happening. And also, please, if you haven't already got a ticket, get a ticket for the BCG event, 22nd of April in Nottingham, because this is about bringing good people together to exchange ideas, to do, not simply to talk. That's it for today. David Scott, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back same time on Monday. If you're not a subscriber to UK Column, please subscribe. We can only do what we do with your financial help. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.